Daily administrator versus urgent and another. Judith M. Cofield, Collins Council, William Charter, Steve R. Duffley Council.
Let the court be clear. It'll be better for you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Judith Cofield, and I represent the estate of a 28-year-old child who died after presenting to the emergency room complaining of pain radiating down her left arm, substernal chest pain lasting 5 minutes, pain at rest, not at exertion, and shortness of breath. There she remained in the emergency room, undiagnosed, not worked up for any cardiac issue whatsoever, and she left 1 week later to die. She was not referred to a cardiologist. She was not treated by a cardiologist. She was not seen by a cardiologist, and the defendant here said she had no cardiac issues. That is undisputed. On those facts, with two experts coming to the court, one cardiologist and one emergency room physician, saying there was a breach in the standard of care in the doctor's failure to admit for cardiac issues, failure to work up, failure to send her one flight up for a stress test, a 20-minute non-invasive stress test, which would have diagnosed her not only essential hypertension, but in fact a 70 to 80% stenosis of the LAD or left anterior descending, called the widowmaker. 1 week later, that 70 to 80% stenosis became a 98% pinpoint opening and killed her from the ischemic insult, the lack of blood flow to the heart. And then the heart, which beats top to bottom, inverted, went into atrial fib and stopped from the pressure. And that's when she died. And it was unnecessary because all she needed, as so many routinely do, is to go up and get a stress test, find out that indeed she has coronary artery disease, get a stent, get bypass, get medication. She'd be alive today and I wouldn't be standing here. That is exactly what the plaintiff's expert said. The defendant's experts came to the stand and not only disputed that she needed any workup at the time, she didn't even need, at that time, a cardiologist. More interestingly, to me at least, was when they didn't dispute just my experts, I expect that. They disputed the treating physician, the medical examiner, who said she had what is called concentric hypertrophy. The heart is enlarged all the way around like two concentric circles, perfectly consistently. Oh, they said, no, that's not true. No, I didn't open her. No, I didn't see it. No, I have no slides to review. But no, it was really a genetic abnormality which caused sudden death. So it didn't matter if she got admitted, didn't matter if she got treated, because nothing would have helped her. Sudden death, like you hear athletes, young athletes from football and baseball and basketball, just die like that at age 26. As you might remember, about 3 weeks ago, VMI cadet did. It was not a genetic abnormality. The medical examiner told him what it was. It was long-standing chronic hypertension, which caused concentric hypertrophy, which also combined with the coronary artery disease denosed the LAD. It killed her. It was preventable. This judge took those facts, those opinions from those experts and the treating physician and said, you don't have a prima facie case. Even though the plaintiff very, very clearly showed a breach in the standard of care for failure to admit and work up, alternative treatment, bypass or stenting and medication, which would have increased a lost opportunity because she was then salvageable. That is in the transcript. That is, at best, for the defendant, at very best, a disputable fact. And yet he ignored the disputed facts, one saying she has a genetic abnormality, three others saying, no, I'm sorry, I'm accepting the autopsy findings, and she died from what they said she died from, and it was a breach not to do something about it. He took those facts, and then he said, because this doctor picked up the phone to Dr. Clevin, the cardiologist, to say, hey, doc, according to him, do you think I should do a stress test? And according to the defendant, was told no. That somehow metamorphosized into a superseding intervening event. It is difficult to understand under the law which this court has handed down and which governs, be it Scheer as superseding, intervening, subsequent treaters, or Jenkins concurrent treaters, how he, being Dr. Erdman's, negligence was not, quote, a proximate cause, a contributing proximate cause, one of
the
multiple.
Ms. Cofield, didn't the trial court interpret the defense experts and the plaintiff's experts as saying that on the standard of care issue, before you even get to superseding cause, that the standard of care is the ER doctor works with what he has, and then on things outside of his expertise, like cardiology, he picks up the phone and does a consult.
No problem. That is what should have been done. However, he then had to take the facts which were adduced from Dr. Sarah, Dr. Erdman himself, in part, also from Dr. Garrett, I'm sorry, our cardiologist, as well as Dr. Clevin, the cardiologist on the other end of that telephone, to say, define it, give me the denotation of a consultation. For me, says the cardiologist at issue, that isn't a consultation, that's a request to interpret something. A consult is when I manage a patient, a specific management of a specific patient. I must see the patient. I did not. I must review the chart. I did not.
So your point is that a rational fact finder, a juror, could look at all the evidence and say to him or herself, well, you know, that's just not enough for a formal consult to discharge the standard of care.
Again, he had to, and improperly, judicially decide to accept the definition of a consult from the defense experts as opposed to the definition of a consult, i.e. what constitutes a consult. Is a phone call a consult, or does it mean I have a hands-on physical examination? Or do I review the chart? That is what Dr. Clevin himself said. That has nothing to do with habit, nothing to do with custom, nothing to do with memory. That is his definition of a consultation. He is a cardiologist. He has never in 25 years told anybody what to do with any patient absent a physical exam.
How should we take on board the bill of particulars? What is your argument for how we should receive, not receive, play up, play down the bill
immaterial, of particulars? Immaterial, inapposite to the questions at bar.
But it was, in fact, evidence presented. I mean, the bill of particulars was an exhibit that was presented to the jury, right?
It was over objection.
Okay. But there's no assignment of error saying that the bill of particulars should not have presented to
you. No. It was a rule of evidence. It's not, as they argue, controlling law of the case. It is a evidentiary ruling. An evidentiary ruling does not control subsequent trials. But be that as it may, you can say, and it's quite true, on a bill of particulars, as we all know, the procedural posture is before any evidence is taken. So let's put that in the bowl. It's in the mix. Let
so
it go to the
So your point is it's not a binding admission, but it is an evidentiary admission of some sort, which can be qualified by other evidence in the case.
Again, in apposite to whether or not, as a judicial matter, there were no factual disputes, but it was amenable to summary judgment. You could say that that was even properly admitted. It wouldn't get him any further. Properly admitted, what he has is not an admission against interest, but what he has is, I think Clevin also did something wrong. Let's say I elevate it to that standard or to that level. That doesn't remove it from a contributing proximate cause. Please don't forget, the temporal considerations and constraints here are paramount. He, being Clevin and Erdman, had the consultation at 7:06.
Now,
she remained another
that,
hour.
We don't get the superseding cause until we find out whether there's an initial breach of the standard of care, primary negligence.
deviations, I agree with you, and the deviations in the standard of care appear on the joint appendix at 75 through 6, 131 through 2, 140, 150, 152, 743, 740, 137 through 138, etc. It is no admission for cardiac workup. It is that there was no referral to an immediate referral within 24 hours to a cardiologist, no admission which was required, no stress test which would have made the diagnosis, and no treatment which would have altered the outcome.
If we were to conclude the fair-minded jury could hear those allegations and conclude there was in fact a breach at the time, that pretty much resolves the case on appeal. It goes back for retrial.
I'm sorry, can you repeat?
If we were to conclude that those allegations would permit a rational juror to determine primary negligence, then that we have to bump through quickly the superseding point, but that's the end of the analysis, right?
I agree. I mean, I sponsored that testimony. It's a prima facie case. You can agree with it. You can disagree with it. You can bring back a defense verdict if you want. You cannot understand the medicine or understand it. I could do a good job or a bad job, but it isn't summary judgment. It isn't the judge's right to take the phone call on a disputed factual content and commute, if you will, that into a binding situation which not only ameliorates but exonerates the defendant of his contributing negligence. It is 101. I don't understand the ruling. It was appropriate at the first, and then subsequently on the motion when renewed, granted, of course. The thing I'd like quickly to address, if Your Honors will permit me, of course, is that, and it is what was granted for them, the not only invasion of the province of the jury, but what was here, the habit, custom, and practice. He admits that, Dr. Clevin, the cardiologist, he didn't remember the specifics of the phone call. He said, unequivocally, at 761, 293, 295, I would never in a situation where I did not see the patient, I did not review the chart, I didn't know them from my own office, so I couldn't go to my office. There's no integrated computer. You don't have any idea. I would never have in 25 years on secondhand knowledge of some ED, or excuse me, emergency department's physician's assessment, decide what to do absent a stress test. Never, ever. They say that doesn't come in. How does never, ever not constitute habit? Not that I would sometimes, and they wrongly in their brief say, he said never. If you will please go to the joint appendix at 293 when he makes that, Dr. Clevin explains what I mean by I might have sometimes given an opinion if and only if condition precedent, I examined the patient, I reviewed the chart. He didn't either, uncontroverted. And he explains that's why what he means by it. So it has nothing to do with what he remembers, what was said to him. What it has to do with is his habit, custom, and practice, which he swore under oath and which was unrebutted and which counsel had a right to rebut under the same statute which allowed me to admit that evidence under habit and custom, that he did render specific management on specific patients absent consults. He didn't rebut it.
Didn't really have to go that far. I mean, I read that too. It doesn't seem to me that it is habit. It's just a flat-out statement. I have never done this.
I agree. I said that in the alternative. I just said, this is just what he does. It is that.
Well, but it's more than that. He says, I have never done this. He didn't say, it's not my habit to do this, or that it is my habit, or I do it 10% of the time. I have never done this. I don't understand how that's habit.
You're preaching to the choir. Because that's exactly what I said. And that's what I said in the brief as well. It's immature. You want to argue something. You want to say, I can't give a hypothetical, which is the artifact here. I can't give a hypothetical to a treating physician. I can only give it to an expert. So if I can't give a hypothetical and you swear you don't remember the specifics of it, can I go in the side door if I can't go in the front door, which is the habit? But I agree with you nevertheless. That is the alternative argument. The primary argument is, I've never done it before, and how is that not admissible? Plain out simple. So I liked my little syllogism that, you know, A is always, and B is a habit, and C is never, and that's a habit, so why doesn't A equal C? It does. Never is habit. So you can go in either door you want. You're still going to end up in the living room. The evidence comes in. Thank you very much.
All right.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Bill Charters. I represent Dr. Erdman and Peninsula Emergency Physicians in this case. And I'm going to start with the issue that Justice Kelsey raised, which is the issue about the consult. This case very quickly became one in which the plaintiff's experts testified that if there was a consult, that is, if the emergency department physician consulted, called, spoke to, met with, referred to, consulted with a cardiologist, that he had met the standard of care. There were a lot of, you could do an admission, you could do a consult, you could do a stress test, but they were all were A or B or C. And as the record makes clear, it became at the end of the plaintiff's case that the issue became whether or not there was a consult from our side. And
well,
that's the
whether
issue.
Or not it was a consult, one, and two, the actual content of the consult.
Well, their experts did not qualify. They said if there was a formal consult, that was sufficient.
What implied in that is a formal consult that says you can go ahead and release her. If the consult said, no, absolutely, send her upstairs right now for a stress test.
The need for consult requires that an actual consultation took place. It is less clear that there was any discussion about that the consultation had to include, as an example, that the cardiologist do the right thing or do the things that the appellant cardiologist said should have been done. The issue was an emergency department physician without a specialty in cardiology works up a patient for a cardiology issue, consults a cardiologist. Dr. Sarah, Dr. Garrett, and every other expert that testified said there was a consult. They just said there was.
But is a telephone call...
Yes, sir.
Is a telephone call a consultation, as that term is used in medicine?
Yes, sir. And both Dr. Sarah and Dr. Garrett agreed that the consultation could take place over the phone. Dr. Clevin agreed that consultations can take place over the phone. So that question was answered by all of the...
Can a patient be passed off from one doctor to another when the second doctor has never seen the patient?
Absolutely.
What about Dr. Garrett testifying that a consult is not a consult unless a patient is seen?
Yeah, that's where I'm heading.
At app 143-193.
Well, he also said that is the responsibility of the cardiologist to determine whether or not...
But doesn't that alone make it a question for the jury? If in fact there is testimony that from one that a consultation requires the cardiologist to actually see the person, and testimony from another that, no, you can have a telephone consultation, doesn't that alone take it out of the realm of summary judgment?
No, sir, because I think the distinction is what a cardiologist says a cardiologist needs to do when called by an emergency department physician.
Did trial counsel in this case object to that testimony? Say that's outside of his specialty and his qualification? I think that testimony came in without objection.
Dr. Garrett's testimony? He testified about what the consultation was from the cardiologist's perspective. He was a cardiologist.
Okay.
But from the emergency department physician, when he kind of rings the bell, cardiology consultation, by calling the cardiologist, which happens literally every day in the emergency department, it then becomes what the cardiologist is supposed to do, which maybe you don't need to call back.
So what you're saying is that the emergency room physician would say that a telephone call is a consultation.
And everybody...
And a cardiologist would say, in fact did say, that a telephone call is not a consultation.
He said it is not a sufficient consultation. That Dr. Clevin, if he didn't go in and see him in person, violated the standard of care.
So what am I missing that allows this to be taken from the jury when you've got that sort of testimony?
Because Dr. Clevin, the cardiologist, is not the emergency department physician.
Well, if that's the case, how about Dr. Sierra on page 251 of the appendix? And this, he is an emergency room physician.
He is.
And he says... Well, I don't particularly want to parse the term consult. I think if you're talking with somebody, to some degree, you're looking for some information or advice. It's not a formal consult, but to the degree that information is exchanged, it can be helpful to an emergency room physician, but it's not a full or formal consult to talk to someone on the phone.
But he then, later on that page, says, and you rely on that advice, and you're entitled to rely on what they tell you. The issue of whether this is a consult or a fair consult, I think, is answered by the bill of particulars. The plaintiff says that he's a consultant. He's been consulted. I mean, that's the, whatever kind of words you want to use, that's the conclusory words that the plaintiff uses in saying in the bill of particulars that he's a consultant. Now, whether as the consultant, when he's called, it's easier to think of it as a neurosurgeon, an emergency department physician calls and says, you know, I don't know what to do with this guy. I think he may need neurosurgery on the phone. And there's a lot of options of what that person might do. He might say, send him to my office. He might say, admit him to the hospital. He might say, run certain tests. He may see the person. Somebody else may see him. He may refer him to a different kind of surgeon. The fact that there is not a personal interaction once the referral is made is on, that's the responsibility of the consultant, the person who has been consulted.
Well, that's not what Dr. Garrett said, did he?
Yes, he said you can do it over the phone.
He says Erdman couldn't rely on Clevin until Clevin showed up and did his job, I thought.
No, he said Dr. Clevin needed to show up and do that. He did say he could rely on him. That was the whole point of his testimony at that juncture. It was Dr. We can agree that Erdman consulted Clevin. We can agree with that. It's right here. This is Garrett on 199. That's correct. It became Clevin's responsibility to show up, as you believe, in the emergency department and evaluate this patient. It became the cardiologist's job, once he was consulted, to do those things or to not do them as he saw fit. It's not the emergency department's position to second guess the consultant, and one of those consultants' actions might be not to come in.
But how do we know what the conversation was in the alleged consult? Let's give it the name consult. How do we know what was said?
Well, we know because Dr. Erdman testified as
well.
Well,
he's the guy being sued.
Well, and it was corroborated that he spoke to Clevin and what Clevin said about the result of the conversation because he discussed it with Mrs. Bailey.
But the other guy to the telephone call said, I would never say that. I have never in my career said that to anybody.
Well, what he really said was, I wouldn't say that about, you know, Sloan Bailey by name, but I would say that about a patient who was like Sloan Bailey, and that I might do all that simply over the phone.
Wasn't the trial judge resolving credibility disputes and ruling on the motion for summary judgment?
No, I think that...
He was making determinations as to what was probably said or not said in this phone conversation. No.
I think he made a determination as to whether or not there was a consult. The issue became, by all the experts, if there's a consult, standard of care was met by the emergency department physician. He made that clear in the initial motion to strike. That's the issue. Isn't that what we're talking about? And that was the only issue that trial counsel for the plaintiff argued about, that became the whole issue. That's what got argued about on the motion to strike. Was there a consul or not? All the experts agreed there was a consul. Judicially, the plaintiff has admitted in the case below that there was a consult by the Bill of Particulars. However you want to describe the consult, there was one. Nobody had said from the emergency department perspective that the emergency department physician had to do anything other than consult him. Because remember, the other alternative was simply to refer him to a cardiologist. He'd be sent there. He might never get there. The person might never see him. So it's not fair to put on the emergency department physician from the standard of care the obligation to ensure that the actions of the consultant were proper. And in fact, everybody testified that they weren't. But that doesn't somehow sneak back into the emergency department physician who doesn't have the same degree of knowledge and experience. If Dr. Clevin said exactly what Dr. Erdman testified to, which was, I spoke to him over the phone, he said she didn't need a stress test and that she could go home.
Well, suppose for the sake of my question, I agree completely that if that was actually said to the ER doctor, the ER doctor's off the hook. Just how do we know that was actually said? And can't a rational fact finder conclude, I don't think it was anywhere near that clear. I don't know what was said, but I don't think it was that clear.
Well, you don't know from the other end that it wasn't said. I mean, it's uncontradicted that he had a conversation with him. I mean, there is no evidence that, as in previous cases, that he didn't provide all of the information. I mean, the fact that Dr. Clevin doesn't remember the conversation at all. I mean, if Dr. Clevin had come in and said, that's exactly what happened, that's exactly what I said, how do we know that's not the circumstance? In fact, we're much closer to that than otherwise. You know, from the evidence that was proffered, that's the conversation that was had. Ms. Bailey corroborates that conversation that was had. But the import of it is he was consulted. If he needed different information or more information, that is the cardiologist, it was his obligation, as was the uncontradicted testimony, he needed to undertake whatever efforts he needed to do to make sure that the standard of care for a cardiologist was met. That was the cardiologist's testimony, that he needed to do that. That was Dr. Sarah's testimony of what the cardiologist needed to do. He needed to either be referred to him, consulted with him. It's all the same thing. They've admitted he was a consultant in their pleadings, which I think they are bound by. Their experts agreed there was a consult.
But it doesn't matter what was said during the consult. That's the part I just don't understand about your argument.
Well,
isn't there an issue remaining that even if the conversation was exactly as Dr. Erdman testified, that perhaps he should have recognized that as inadequate, that I really can't make a decision to admit or not admit or stress test, not stress test, based on this telephone conversation with a colleague who hasn't seen the patient?
Well, that hypothetically, somebody could have said that. But what they said was, if you consulted the cardiologist, you met the standard of care. That was kind of the uncontradicted testimony, is that if you did that, you referred him to a cardiologist. I think the term was exactly referred immediately. Can't get much more immediate than picking up the phone and calling right then. That the referral was made. The consult was made. The consultant, the cardiologist, once he gets that call, as everybody testified, becomes responsible within that area of control to do whatever else he thinks necessary. That may be come and see the patient. It may mean send him to the office. It may mean admit him to the hospital. It may mean run a stress test. It may mean all kinds of things for the cardiologist but it is a result of the emergency department physician saying, I don't have the expertise, I need to rely on you to make this decision. And everybody agreed that it was appropriate if he was contacted and consulted and became a consultant, as the pleadings admit, there's no error brought to this court on that, that once that was accomplished, he met the standard of care, and he was thereafter not primarily negligent. And I agree, we don't need to get to all kinds of other process, although I think the court properly found that by an uncontradicted testimony that Dr. Clevin himself was negligent. Time's up. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
In my 45 seconds, I would like to say that in response to Your Honor's inquiry, it was over objection that Schwartz, a cardiologist proffered by the defendant, was qualified on the appropriateness on the conduct of a cardiologist. That brings you full circle into the quagmire, if you will, of the superseding intervening, admittedly. However, it was over objection, and then when I continued to object, I was permitted a continuing objection as to all standard of care as to a cardiologist. So I would like that noted for the record. It partially appears on page 24 of the transcript. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Call the next case.